From 90.5 WESA, this is The Confluence. Every year, the state invests tens of millions of dollars to spur economic development through tax incentives to outright grants to businesses to get them to come or stay. Is it an effective use of taxpayer money? While some states are moving away from mandatory minimum sentences, Pennsylvania lawmakers want to reestablish the sentences for certain crimes.
It's a one-size-fits-all solution to sentencing, and it gives judges very little room to make their own discretionary choices.
For a fourth straight year, the Pittsburgh region has lost population, more deaths than births. The flight of the black middle class, too few immigrants.
For a city that was once viewed as a great melting pot, now we're the least diverse metropolitan region in America of our size.
And remembering Steelers chairman and former ambassador to Ireland, Dan Rooney. The Confluence follows this news update. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Later in the program, Pennsylvania lawmakers want to reinstate mandatory minimum sentences in the Pittsburgh area's empty generation, plus a remembrance of Steelers chairman Dan Rooney. But first, it's good news when a company announces it's staying in the area, maybe expanding its operations, increasing its workforce, or establishing a new operation, a new facility in the region. But that often comes with government incentives, tax credits, tax incentives, outright grants, loans. So is it really good news? We're exploring that question today through the changes to a huge land site in Westmoreland County over the last 40 years. It was home to Volkswagen and then Sony. And now, Mike Wershagen is an investigative reporter for The Caucus, a weekly newspaper covering state government and politics. Mike, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or comment, tweet us using the hashtag WESAConfluence.
The event in which we participate this morning is perhaps the most significant economic occurrence in western Pennsylvania since the days of Andrew Carnegie.
That was Pennsylvania Governor Milton Schaap in 1978 talking about Volkswagen's first U.S. plant in New Stanton. Mike, the story of that site actually began about 10 years before that, though, with Chrysler, did it not?
That's correct, yes. Chrysler is the company that actually built the plant, and they built it in the late 1960s, but they never actually opened up operations there. Right around the time they were wrapping up construction, the market took a bit of a dip, and they sort of backed away from it. And so Westmoreland County was left with this huge, huge site. Like you said, I mean, this is a massive industrial site, something on the order of 2.8 million square feet.
So then that was, as I said, 10 years before VW actually opened its plant. So it was we're talking now 5 decades of this site, basically.
Indeed. Yeah, this is a half century old economic development project.
OK, so the VW era, that was the beginning of your investigative piece.
Yeah, the VW portion of this is where things really got going in terms of state involvement. That's when Milton Schaap decided that he was going to commit a rather large chunk of state resources to try to attract a company to this site. He took a very activist role in the idea of economic development. Now, you have to remember, this is a time when the steel industry was beginning its precipitous decline.
Right.
They're staring at these numbers, and they were
scared.
Terrified.
Yeah.
I mean, the Western Pennsylvania's economy was about to fall off a cliff, and so Governor Schaap decided, we're going to do whatever we can to bring somebody in here. And so what they ended up doing was putting together an aid package worth about $90 million in 1976 dollars. Now, in today's dollars, it's closer to $362 million for inflation.
Part of that was a loan, part of it was infrastructure investment.
Right, right. So what they were doing was they spent about $40 million to rehab the actual site, and then they spent another $50 million on things like a rail connection that went for 3 to 4 miles, and another highway connection that went for about 6 miles to connect it to some of the main highways that are out there. The Turnpike is right there, I-70 is right there, and you've got a transcontinental railroad spur right next door.
And with that rail connection, was that to actually move the cars from plant to get it onto the rails?
Correct.
For transport around the country?
Right, right. And so Volkswagen decided that this was enough of an incentive to bring them here to make the Rabbit, which is now known as the Golf. But at the time, it was the Diesel Rabbit. And this was a huge coup. Milton Schaap sent a state worker on this secret trade mission overseas, and because he had heard that Ohio was trying to lure Volkswagen in. Mm-hmm. And he said to them, well, look, we can put together a better package, plus our workers don't get paid as much as they do in Cleveland. That was actually part of his sales pitch, because the wages are lower here.
Okay. So, well, that's good news for the employer, not so good news for the employee, I guess.
It's good news. It's not so good news if you're comparing yourself to Cleveland, but it's pretty good news if you're comparing yourself to unemployment.
Okay. So now, is this, from your research, the first, in terms of commitment of government dollars, let's face it, taxpayer dollars, to bring somebody here?
This was a shift in philosophy for the state. The state has always been, government has always been involved in industry to some degree or another, but this was really an unprecedented effort. He was betting big on this, and he came right out and said this. As he said in that video or that audio clip, I'm sorry, this is he expected it to be the biggest economic development in Western Pennsylvania since the days of Andrew Carnegie. He didn't parse his words at all. He said, this is going to save the region.
Mm. There was pride in that.
Absolutely. These were good jobs. These were well-paying, union wages, benefits. The plant at its peak, a couple of years after it opened, employed 5,700 people. Now, it's in between two towns. One of them, New Stanton, has 2,200 people. The other one, Mount Pleasant, has about 4,400 people. And there's a 5,700 strong workforce at this one plant right between the two of them. Business boomed everywhere around it because all of a sudden you had a large workforce with disposable income in, an area that was being starved of that.
Paying their personal income taxes, paying their sales taxes. What about business taxes, though?
Well, that was a bit of a point of contention, because part of the aid package that Governor Schaap put together included a 95% reduction in their local taxes for the first few years. Now, there were two things that happened because of that. You had local business owners saying, wait, I got to pay my taxes. And you're telling me Volkswagen, this huge multinational corporation, mm-hmm. That has the money to spend $250 million on this plant, can't pony up their share of the taxes. And at the same time, you had local officials saying, you're going to bring 5,700 people in here. We're going to have to protect them. We're going to have to serve them. We're going to have to do all the things that we have to do for them. And we're not going to get any more money. Like, how is this going to work? So it was contentious even back then.
Okay, we're going to bring us up to date to what's happening in that area right now. But a couple more questions. Volkswagen, was it, within 3 years it hit 500,000 rabbits or something like that? And so was it on target? Was it a success for a while?
For a while, it absolutely was.
And then what happened?
Well, depends who you ask. But there was a production line worker at the time who said that Volkswagen had just misread the American market. Volkswagen prided itself on these very well-engineered cars, and they thought, well, that's what's going to sell these cars. That's why consumers will come to us, because they're so well-engineered. But this line worker said, in this country, we like our bells and whistles. And the Rabbit, I don't know if you've ever seen one. That's not an extravagant car. There's not a lot of...
Efficient.
Right. And the German point of view is, this is an efficient car. The American point of view was, there's nothing in it. So people kind of soured on it, and sales dipped.
Okay, sales dipped. All right. We're talking with Mike Warshak, an investigative reporter for The Caucus, a weekly newspaper covering state government and politics. And we're looking at government investments in terms of loans and tax credits in major economic development projects, and whether they actually pay off for the citizens, for the taxpayers, for the local governments. And we're using as our focus point that big tract of land in the New Stanton area that housed Volkswagen and then Sony. So once the Volkswagen plant closes, Mike, did they immediately start trying to now recruit another big tenant?
They did. As soon as it happened, when they closed down in 1988, Governor Casey then said that he told people that this is now my number one economic development priority. He immediately said we need to get somebody else in here. And so he started cobbling together state resources, just like Governor Schapp had done. He eventually came up with about $40 million in 1990 dollars. And that's roughly $75 million today. And that brought Sony in. Now, Sony didn't come in with the same size workforce that Volkswagen had at its peak. They topped out at about 3,500. But again, 3,500, you know, it's better
than
nothing.
Zero. Right. Yes. Okay. So they actually lasted. Sony lasted on there longer than Volkswagen did. So they're making the big televisions, and then they start shipping some of the operations to Mexico, and then within a matter of some years after that happens, it's gone.
Yes, and they had, during that period of time, they were also getting state grants to keep workers in the area. I mean, you had critics of that policy saying you're bribing a company to keep jobs here. But, you know, from Governor Rendell's perspective, he was trying to, you know, keep employment at this plant. And eventually he gave him $1 million in the mid-2000s. And in return, they promised to keep 1,800 employees at the plant. But a couple of years later, they were gone.
Okay, Mike, I want to shift to another county, then we're going to come back to Westmoreland County. Last week, the Pittsburgh Regional Alliance released a report, its annual business investment scorecard, saying the largest ever amount of capital investment was in 2016, more than $10 billion across the 10-county region. Of course, that number is skewed, inflated by the $6 billion ethane cracker plant. But what's not mentioned there is $1.6 billion in tax incentives over 25 years.
Right, right. See, when... and that's often an easy thing for some government officials to offer up, in that it seems like it's win-win. You lower the taxes for a while, you bring somebody in, and they you get this ancillary benefit of these workers who are paying their wage taxes and they're buying things, so they're paying sales taxes, and so the idea is that you sacrifice some in one area, but you gain in another area. The problem you can run into, though, is like the local officials around the new Stanton plant were worried about, that you have this large influx of people and the needs that accompany them, and you're not getting the money from your tax base to support the services that they require.
Okay, I mentioned the ethane cracker because, again, a huge tenant, a major anchor, if you would, is expected to have a sizable workforce. And now I'm going to move back to Westmoreland County. What's happening there now? Again, another big one, or are we going to smaller investments, smaller developments?
It is the latter. What happened after Sony pulled out is they shifted. The Regional Industrial Development Corporation, which owns the site, shifted its focus, and they stopped looking for these huge corporations to move in as. The president of the RIDC told me, he said, there are only so many woolly mammoths out there.
He said, nothing lasts forever.
He said, nothing
quote.
Lasts forever. Right. So what they're doing now is they're focusing on smaller tenants. Instead of one company that needs 2.8 million square feet, they want a bunch of companies that need 100,000 to 300,000 square feet. And they're prepping the site for those people to move in, for those employers to move in. The idea being, one of the ideas being that, of course, you get jobs because these people are still employing folks. But the other idea is that if any one of these companies goes belly up, it is not going to sink the plant. You have this, it's sort of like diversifying your portfolio.
Right. Okay. In our remaining minute or so, now, this was a lot of government taxpayer money invested in this tract of land in Westmoreland County. Have there been success stories through the region as you did your research? Have there been success stories of major investments?
Yeah. For a time, like the man said, nothing lasts forever. But this project in particular, the state has invested an inflation-adjusted amount of about $500 million over the years. Now, during that time, There were 5,700 people at the plant for a while. There were 3,500 people at the plant for a while. There have been stretches of time when you've had employees at this facility who wouldn't have been there without this government incentive. Now, the opposing view to that is, no, but they'd be someplace else, which is you just have to let the market figure these things out. That's, you know, that's a sound theory, but if you're living next door to this plant, if your business depends on customers who get paid by a manufacturer, you know, it's just not an easy call. You need somebody or you go down with the plant.
Mike Wershagen is an investigative reporter for the Caucus, a weekly newspaper covering state government and politics. Mike, as always, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
While other states are moving from mandatory minimum sentences, Pennsylvania looks to reinstate them. That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. A little later in the program, reflections on Dan Rooney, the Steelers chairman who died yesterday at age 84. But first, two major law enforcement-related measures are making their way through the Pennsylvania legislature. One brings back mandatory minimum prison sentences in the Commonwealth, and the other would block the release for 30 days of the identity of a police officer involved in a deadly shooting or use of force resulting in serious injury. We're going to discuss the reasons behind those bills and possible implications with Sarah Ann Hughes, a reporter for The Incline. Welcome, Sarah Ann. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
And if you have a question or comment, you can tweet us. Use hashtag WESA Confluence. Okay, let's start with mandatory minimum sentencing legislation. It received final House approval last week, House approval, 122 to 67, 12 Democrats voting yes, and is now in the Senate Judiciary Committee. So mandatory minimums, popular nationally starting out in the 80s and the 90s in Pennsylvania. A lot of that was due to the crack epidemic and the associated crimes. Sarah Ann, Pennsylvania's law was struck down, though, very recently. Why so?
Sure. So to talk about Pennsylvania's ruling, we first have to talk about a U.S. Supreme Court ruling from 2013. In that case, a majority of the justices found that there's a fact in a case that leads to an increase in a sentence. Then that fact has to go before a jury. And so that was at the heart of the 2015 ruling by the PA Supreme Court. In that case, the crime was alleged to have occurred in a drug-free school zone.
Okay. And which sort of area? How far are these drug-free school zone areas?
Sure. So a drug-free school zone area is within 1,000 feet of a school or 250 feet of a playground or recreation center.
Okay.
So essentially in that case, the PA Supreme Court said, you know, if you want to tack 2 years onto this man's sentence because he was in a school zone, that fact has to go before a jury first. So that ruling essentially invalidated all of Pennsylvania's mandatory minimum sentences. Now, it didn't strike them down completely. It was sort of a temporary setback. Almost immediately after that ruling, you had Republican representatives reintroduce a bill that would revive mandatory minimums for violent offenses. Eventually, nonviolent drug offenses were also added onto that bill. And then you had a separate bill introduced last session that only applied to firearms, to crimes committed with firearms. Neither of those bills made it into law.
Okay.
But they're rearing their head again this session.
Okay. Joining us in the conversation is from Harrisburg, Katie Meyer, who is the Capitol Bureau Chief for WESA and other public radio stations across the state. Welcome back to the show, Katie.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So we're talking about mandatory minimums, why they were struck down by the courts and where they're proceeding right now. House having passed it. It's now, I believe, in the Senate Judiciary Committee. So we mentioned that the House passed similar legislation in the last session.
But the Senate, Katie, did not get around to acting on it. Did we run out of time? What was the scenario there?
That's right. Yeah, essentially, yes, they ran out of time. I mean, it's a controversial issue. So once we get towards the end of a session, you know, moving these things sort of becomes like, you know, a way to test the waters, see how it could do when they have, again, more time to mess around with it a little bit. So we're seeing it rear its head again like we do with a lot of bills at the beginning of a session. And, you know, it's in the Senate again now. We'll see how it goes. It, generally speaking, this bill, yes, would have much more trouble passing the Senate than it would the House.
Why so? I mean, with the, you know, you tend to think, quote, law and order legislation. You tend to think you would get Republican support, and the Republicans have basically a 2-to-1 majority in the Senate.
Absolutely. And, I mean, it's not a totally partisan piece of legislation, but there are a lot of various political interests that go into this. One of the big things is that, you know, the state's trying to reduce corrections costs right now. And this mandatory minimum sentencing, you know, these guidelines would, you know, they would keep more people in prison longer, which does increase costs. And it's been projected, the corrections department put it out there, as being between $40 and $85 million a year more in costs for this. And, I mean, the GOP's budget that they just put out did call for additional cuts to correction spending on top of what Wolf had proposed. So, I mean, it's definitely, I think it's a law and order bill. So, yes, it does have strong GOP support. But, there's going to be, you know, a financial factor in all of this that Republicans and Democrats are going to consider.
Yeah, and I'll add to that. So last session, the two bills that were on, there was a firearms bill, and there was a larger bill that had nonviolent drug offenses and violent offenses. And Joseph Markosek, who is a representative from Allegheny County, voted in favor of one and not in favor of the other, which may seem sort of like a you know, a contradiction. But his spokesperson said essentially the firearms bill had no financial impact. And for him, that, you know, that made the bill viable, but the huge financial impact of this one, I think, is a big reason why some people are voting against it.
Okay, let's take a look at this particular piece of legislation, again passed by the House, sitting in Senate committee right now. The bill would institute mandatory minimums ranging from 2 to 5 years for what, Katie?
For, I mean, a variety of offenses. I think it's mostly drug and crime offenses. I think that's what you're looking for here. And these, again, were all of the offenses that were found unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. So it really, it reinstates laws that were already in place that now, I mean, many people are saying should be gone, but, you know, others say should come back for a public safety point of view.
Sarah Ann, do the supporters of this new bill, this new version, believe it addresses those constitutionality questions that the state Supreme Court brought up?
Yeah, absolutely. So the bills, all of the bills that have been introduced on this subject, require these facts to go before the fact finder, which in most cases is the jury. And so Dom Costa was at who's a representative from Allegheny County, was at a press conference with Stephen Zappala, who is Allegheny County's district attorney, and said he didn't think that this would come to any legal challenges.
Okay. We're talking about the move back toward mandatory minimum sentencing in Pennsylvania with WESA's Capitol Bureau Chief Katie Meyer and with Sarah Ann Hughes, reporter for The Incline. So there seems to be a very sharp divide over whether mandatory minimums will help reduce crime, make our streets safer.
My sense is that there's very little disagreement among law enforcement with respect to these particular categories.
We don't need mandatory minimums. We're going in the right direction as a commonwealth with regards to criminal justice reform. This takes us back to the draconian era.
Okay, that first voice we heard was Allegheny County DA Stephen Zappala that Sarah Ann alluded to just a moment ago, and that was followed by Representative Jordan Harris. Mr. Harris is a Democrat from Philadelphia. So let's start with you, Katie. Is that sort of the two main perspectives on this legislation?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. You really have, you know, the Democrats. And when I say the Democrats, this is Corrections Secretary John Wetzel, who's in a Democratic administration, plus the governor, plus a lot of Democrats, especially from as Representative Harris is from the city areas. He's from Philadelphia. And those people, yes, they tend to say, we don't need these things. And the argument, too, it's largely based off of a 2009 study that the state did that, you know, whether or not this is effective, whether or not this actually makes a difference in getting people, you know, cutting down on crime. And they argue that, no, it doesn't, that, you know, when somebody is committing a crime, that they don't really take into account the length of the potential sentence they would be serving. So that's one argument. The other one that we hear from, you know, proponents of the bill, Todd Stevens, has been, you know, the main, you know, pusher of this bill. And he's a Montgomery County representative, a Republican. He's saying, you know, by imprisoning people for a longer period of time, that this will help, you know, for one thing, curb the opioid epidemic in the state, and, you know, it will keep violent offenders off of streets. Now, you also get into the argument, you know, Secretary Wetzel has made the argument that, well, since, you know, this these rules have been, you know, invalidated by the Supreme Court, that we haven't seen a dramatic uptick in crime, which, you know, that's an argument that you'll hear from him a lot, you know, that we haven't seen a difference. And Stevens pushes back on that. He says, well, I mean, a lot of these people are still serving their sentences, so we would need more time to figure out exactly what the impact of this is. So essentially what we're hearing from all sides is sort of them interpreting, you know, data differently, you know, interpreting the effects of this law differently. So it's become a very contentious issue.
Okay. I want to point out, so it does fall pretty much along party lines, but of course the DA, Stephen Zappala, is a Democrat. So, Sarah, I want to bring up in your report that you did for The Incline, included a statement from another Pittsburgh state rep, Dan Frankel, that said the mandatory minimums are disproportionately affecting minorities, but he also said victims might prefer leniency in some cases. However, the Pennsylvania Office of the Victim Advocate supports the bill. So what did he tell you? And is that the sort of the two arguments that you've heard, though, that Katie was talking about?
Yeah, I mean, as Katie said, there are you can look at the same issue in a lot of different ways. You know, in this case, so Frankel didn't provide any specifics when he was talking about victims who may actually wish to have leniency in some cases. On the, you know, the flip over the same coin, Zappala, when he was talking about crimes, you know, against elderly people, against infants, these horrible crimes, he was asked to bring up some specific cases where people who had committed those crimes had not received a proper sentence, and he couldn't name any cases. He said, you know, for us, this is more a matter of principle. This is, you know, this is to take a stance and to say, you know, that these crimes are not acceptable.
Okay, we have just 2 minutes left, and I want to get to another piece of legislation that is moving through the chambers, and that would be holding for 30 days or until an investigation is concluded, the identity of a police officer involved in a shooting or use of force. Governor Wolf said that he would veto this legislation.
Yes,
it basically puts a bullseye in the backs of police officers in Pennsylvania. We'd be the only state to block the release of officers' identities for 30 days. I'm concerned that in a time when what we want to do is make sure that we're bringing the police force and the communities closer together, this is just one more way to drive a wedge between them.
Okay, Katie, follow up on what the governor said there.
Yes. Sorry, I'm having trouble hearing you.
Okay, Katie, your reaction to what the governor said. No surprise there, right?
No, there's no surprise there. So basically, and my reporting on this is sort of centered around the possibility of, you know, a veto that could happen. Wolf, you know, vetoed this bill last session. It got to him, struck down. Now it's been brought back. And, you know, it has a lot of support in both the House and the Senate, and some bipartisan support as well. So there are, you know, as I've tallied them up, there are enough votes, in fact, for the legislature to override a veto from the governor. So that would be a situation. We don't see these very often. We haven't seen, you know, a veto override since, I believe, 2009, or 2010, actually.
10, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, it's a possibility on this bill. So that's going to be a very interesting thing to watch out for.
And what are you looking for in this story, Sarah? And we have just a minute left.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, as Katie said, there is bipartisan support for this legislation, huge bipartisan support, especially in Allegheny County, where only three Democrats oppose it, one Republican, and in the Senate, only Jay Costa opposed it the last time around. But I will say that there are detractors, the ACLU of Pennsylvania, and also Elizabeth Pittenger, who is executive director of the Citizen Police Review Board here in Pittsburgh, who's called the bills outrageous and said it's unconscionable that public officials who violate this act could be charged with a second-degree misdemeanor. You know, she said it's taking away information, knowledge, and awareness, and that's just wrong.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to close our conversation right there. We'll be looking forward to see what happens in the legislature. Katie Myers, Capitol Bureau Chief for WESA, and Sarah Ann Hughes is a reporter for The Incline. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For four straight years, the Pittsburgh region has lost population. We'll discuss the empty generation and what it means to the future of our area. That and remembering Dan Rooney, when the confluence continues on 90.5 WESA. It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The U.S. Census Bureau recently released population estimates for July 2016, showing a fourth consecutive decline for the seven-county Pittsburgh region, down another nearly 9,000 residents. Joining us to talk about what this general population trend, as well as seemingly a similar one among African-American middle-class residents in this area, Gary Rutstein, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and his colleague, Tim Grant, a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So a few numbers before we get into some of the reasons and, you know, what you learned in your reporting. 2.3 million in this region, lowest in 10 years. Allegheny County lost about 2.1% of its population. Armstrong seems to have the largest loss per county, 9.5%, slight increases for Butler and Washington. So, gentlemen, whether it's African-Americans or whites or any ethnic group in this region, is this region overall still feeling the fallout of the loss of the exodus, if you would, a few decades ago due to decline of heavy industry? Gary, let's start with you.
Pittsburgh's like nowhere else. That's what I find amazing about these numbers sometimes, is just how wacky we are demographically. And it does go back in large part to all the people who left in the 70s, 80s, and 90s during the manufacturing downturn. But it's not just that they left. There are all these ripples and echoes that take effect for a generation afterwards or more that we're feeling now. Because not only did those people leave, the children that they would have had or had who would be having babies here now left with them, and it's very tough for Pittsburgh to grow. Outside of Florida, there's very few big cities like Pittsburgh that don't grow.
The anecdotes or the stories that you've developed from the people you've talked to, whether it's hard numbers or not, those stories are important. Those reasons are important to those individuals, whether, as I said, we have hard numbers on it or not, and they have their own reasons for staying, succeeding, or even leaving.
Absolutely. What I found in my reporting was that people who are more likely to leave would be people who moved to Pittsburgh,
right.
Non-natives, who would be more likely to leave would be those who moved to Pittsburgh from other major cities where they had a more thriving middle-class African-American population. In many cases, people who decided to leave here had very affluent lifestyles. They had very good jobs, but in other cases, people who landed very good positions here after moving here decided that they would stay, and they found reasons to.
All right, so you referenced two different groups there, if you would. People who moved here had maybe a more vibrant lifestyle in a middle-class lifestyle and then came to Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh did not necessarily fulfill that, and they left, and others who found a niche, if you would. Is that right?
That is right. I think the people who are more likely to stay are those who do find their niche, and very often they come here with families, and they have a support network, and they don't feel the sense of isolation that those who might be single would feel, because there is a huge, I think one person that I quoted said that you would never mistake Pittsburgh for Washington, D.C. There are stark differences when it comes to African-Americans especially.
Yeah, I think they also mentioned Atlanta in that quote as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
And so whether it is African-Americans or whites, Gary, why don't you just also expand upon something you said, the ripple effect. It's one thing if you lose tens of thousands of people, but that ripple effect is really the key. It's because we're missing their children's children.
We end up becoming a region where more people die than are born every year. That's been the case for two decades now. There's no other city our size where that's taking place. But what that means is that people talk all the time about wanting Pittsburgh to grow. We've got one arm tied behind our back trying to do that.
Because what's that arm?
The arm has to do with babies not being born.
Yeah.
Or with the aging of our population that is so skewed. This is all gradually changing. The rest of the United States is catching up to us in terms of aging, but we started out so far ahead of and differently from the rest of the nation and comparable cities in this regard that we've had a really tough time growing. And people can debate how great or not it is to grow, as some places grow too fast. So we don't have to, though people hate traffic here, it would be 10 times worse if all those people hadn't left in the 80s and 90s, believe me. But we've got a lot of issues here that we struggle with because of non-growth.
So we've heard the term white flight, and we're normally referring that to as whites leaving the city to go to the suburbs. Tim, is there a black flight in this region?
When I began reporting on this story, in many ways I was telling my own story as an African American.
Oh, okay.
A non-native of Pittsburgh who moved here for career reasons. And I find that there are some people who move here and they find a niche. I have. I'm married now, and I feel like I've found a place that I enjoy living. But there are others who come here and they struggle to find social networks. They struggle to find the kinds of outlets that they would in a major city with a larger affluent African-American population. And I think that it's hard to know who's going to make it or not. I see people all the time who come and go because they just don't find a way to fit in.
Did you find your story in other people's stories?
Absolutely, I did. When I moved here, the first thing I asked the people I knew was, where are the African-American middle-class neighborhoods? And I always got a blank stare. They couldn't tell me. And so I quickly realized that the population was so scattered that there was no real concentration.
And that becomes part of another very wacky demographic about Pittsburgh.
You've used wacky a couple of times.
We are wacky, and I'm from here, and I love that we're quirky. I think maybe wacky is another version for quirky, and quirky we're proud of. Wacky, I don't know. But we are the least diverse city in America, or a metropolitan region in America, of our size. And part of that is we have a lower than customary African-American population, partly because we don't hold the ones of great ambitions and education, maybe, who don't find a niche here. The other thing that's maybe more important than that is that we don't attract a great deal of international immigrants, especially Hispanics or blue collar. We get the professional upper class kind of international migration associated with the universities and hospitals. But the fact is, we don't have the same number of blacks, the same proportion of international immigrants as other places. So for a city that was once, I think, viewed as a great melting pot a century ago because of all the steel mills attracting European immigration elsewhere, now we're the least diverse place. And for a lot of millennials, that makes us less interesting of a place to be in because they love diversity.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're talking about the loss of population for the last few years in the Pittsburgh metro area, and we're speaking with Gary Rotstein, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and Tim Grant, a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Tim, 5 years ago, another reporter, Ben Schmidt, did a piece for Pittsburgh Quarterly. He posed the question, why isn't Pittsburgh, the region, sustaining a black middle class. Is that question still valid today?
I think it's very valid. And a lot of it has to do with the isolation that many African-American people from the middle class feel in a city that is, for the most part, working class. I mean, we have so many people who come here for professional jobs. They don't have any family roots. They don't have roots within the community. So they find themselves searching around for social networks. And very often, those are difficult. Unless you you seek out the church, or you are involved in some fraternity or some other social club that may have national extensions. The economic issue is another big one. You know, in fact, when Gary and I had our first meeting on this, on the project we did on the black middle class, the flight and the lifestyles here, the first thing we asked ourselves was, what is middle class? You know,
And is there a different definition for African Americans?
There absolutely is a different definition for African Americans because of the wealth gap and the income disparities. African Americans have a more lenient definition for middle class than you would have in the white community. Their idea of a middle class does not entirely rest on income. It's
education factors.
Education is a big factor. Depending on the job you have, you would be considered middle class, even if that if the income or the salary for that job would be below the median salary for the middle class. One of the people that I interviewed, I think he said it best. He said that you won't find a lot of African Americans at the Steelers games and the Pirates games because of the income disparities in this city, and that African Americans are on the low income side of that. And these events cost money, which is why you may see fewer African Americans participating in these large events that we have in the city.
This is one other thing that is more difficult for blacks in Pittsburgh than elsewhere. Is in every city you go to, there are sizable disparities between black and white economics and income and all. The problem we have is the gap is even larger here than is the case with the nation at large, with other cities like Atlanta and Washington and other northern cities with large black populations. And the gap is getting even wider between blacks and whites here than it was 10, 20, 30 years ago. Every time there's census information put out, looking at household income, at home ownership, educational levels, the gulf between whites and blacks becomes worse in Pittsburgh when we would hope it would be narrowing.
Gary, in your recent story about Pittsburgh's empty generation, you say Pittsburghers are often puzzled that it's often portrayed as a vibrant city, get a lot of national attention, but it isn't gaining population. So, gentlemen, in your reporting, as you talk to officials, maybe more importantly, as you talk to citizens and residents, what is it going to take to make Pittsburgh a growing region, not just in technology and in innovation, but more importantly, in people?
That's the huge question. I'm not sure that there's a good answer, because the region has struggled with that for decades now. It's a big topic that Mayor Peduto and County Executive Fitzgerald talk about, is growing the region and setting goals for it. I'm not sure how realistic it is, again, because of some underlying factors. You talk to any economist involved in demographics, they talk about jobs. We do not create jobs in relative terms and in huge amounts compared to other parts of the country. And that's what's the number one thing I'm told is going to drive people here.
Tim, do you think it's going to be like one person's success story or a happiness story or satisfaction story at a time?
Well, I personally think that Pittsburgh is an undiscovered gem in many cases. It was never on my radar when I was living down in Florida. And what created the opportunity for me to move here was a job opportunity at the Post-Gazette. So I think that as you build a community of people, African Americans specifically, who move here for various reasons and find happiness here, I think the people who are attracted here for similar reasons begin to see the merits of this town. And I believe you're right. It may happen just, you know, one success story at a time.
Tim Grant, Gary Rothstein, our reporters for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Gentlemen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And finally, Pittsburgh Steelers chairman Dan Rooney died Thursday after a brief illness. He was 84 years old. For a time during the Obama administration, Mr. Rooney was ambassador to Ireland. Joining us for a few minutes to talk about Dan Rooney is Gene Collier, longtime sports journalist, columnist, author, and co-author of the play The Chief. Gene, thanks for taking a few minutes.
Glad to do it, Kevin.
Gene, Dan Rooney's father, Art Sr., the Chief, had this, I don't know, bigger-than-life personality from how he came up with the money to start the Steelers franchise to the traditional cigar in his mouth. Yet Dan, his son, I don't think was overshadowed by his father's accomplishments.
No, not in retrospect. If you look at everything Dan had done, not only for the National Football League, but for the different causes he believed in Pittsburgh, all the way to Dublin and back, his influences surpassed the Chief, really. The Chief, of course, taught all of his five boys, don't carry on like big shots, he would say. And he'd also tell them, don't let anyone mistake your kindness for weakness. And his influences was monumental. But Dan's actual accomplishments, particularly in football, far surpassed the Chief.
We've talked to Dwayne Woodruff, former Steeler defensive back, now, of course, a judge of the Court of Common Pleas court. And he told us that outside of Judge Woodruff's own father and his father, Dan Rooney was one of the greatest blessings of his life.
Yeah, I'm not surprised by that. You know, I was always fascinated by the way Dan related to so many different types of people and so many different types of players from all walks of life. And he had a particularly charming relationship with Ike Taylor, the longtime defensive back from Louisiana. And they're two guys really with nothing in common. And yet they really, really liked each other and respected each other, even to the extent that Ike Taylor, who often wore his practice pants too low, criticized the owner of the club for wearing his pants too high. Ike even went as far as to come into Dan's office and tell him he was tired, and Dan would say, well, lie down on the couch there if you're tired, and he wouldn't. He'd go to sleep, and Dan would have an appointment, leave, and tell everybody not to disturb Ike. It's just the kind of guy he was. He's just a very real, genuine person.
Well, if you would, you just told us one, but tell us a story in a minute or so about Dan Rooney.
You know, I remember he had this just unbelievable humility, Kevin. I mean, to him, there was nothing that he shouldn't do or have anyone else do for him. He would line up at halftime of the games for a hot dog, stand in the line with, 100 sports writers, where he could, send any number of people over to get him a hot dog and not have to move. Those kinds of things.
Well, Gene, one final thought on Dan Rooney.
Sports traditionalists, Kevin, love to say this phrase, nobody's bigger than the game. But if anybody was close to being bigger than the game, it was Dan Rooney, and he would hate that I said that.
Gene Collier, longtime sports journalist, author, and co-author of the play The Chief. Gene, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin.
And let's give the final word to Lynn Swann, former Steelers wide receiver and Hall of Famer.
Was he a competitor? Yes. Did he want to win? Yes. Did he want to have a team that was always competitive and vying for a championship? Absolutely. But at the heart of what Dan was doing, what Dan, I think, felt was important, was that the league did well and did the right things.
More on the life of Dan Rooney on All Things Considered this afternoon, starting at 4 on 90.5 WESA. And funeral arrangements for Dan Rooney. A funeral mass will be celebrated 11 o'clock Tuesday morning at St. Paul's Cathedral in Oakland. And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer for the program is Tom Hurley. The producer of The Confluence, Marcus Charleston. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news. We'll be right back.